Yes, I believe. I believe in death. I believe in disease. I believe in injustice and humanity and torture and anger and hate. I believe in murder. I believe in pain. I believe in cruelty and infidelity. I believe in slime and stink and every crawling putrid thing. Every possible ugliness and corruption, you son of a bitch. I believe in you.
Okay, welcome back to our faithful 10, 15 listeners to another episode of Well Adjusted. I almost had to pause and think about the title of the podcast. And today we are doing what may be, I'm going to stake a claim, what may be the best exorcism movie ever, including the original The Exorcist,
mm-hmm.
The Exorcist Part 3.
Legion.
Legion, for we are many.
Yeah, and they're pretty adamant in saying it is William Peter Blatty's. Or not William Peter Blatty's. Yeah, it is.
William Peter Blatty's.
Blatty, yeah. We'll go with it.
But I think that's part of him, the specificity there is part of him distancing himself from The Exorcist Part 2.
Yeah.
Which no one should ever watch.
Hot garbage.
It's like all of the Highlander sequels rolled into one.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine to pretend it never even happened.
Yeah.
If only so that you don't have to see James Earl Jones like just struggle, a great actor struggle through that giant pile of dog shit of a script.
It's bad. One of the reviews I actually read for it, doing some research for this film, was that it belongs in a jar in a museum because it's that ugly to look at. But yeah, so The Exorcist scared the crap out of everybody. They had like little warnings before you went in. There were like newspaper articles about people fainting during the film and throwing up during the film.
I want to go to a movie where people faint. Maybe not necessarily throw up, but imagine being in a movie that was so effective.
People fainted.
People just dropped into the aisles.
Damn, we're seeing some shit here, you know? And then it had a lot to do with the culture war and the flower power versus the generation before them and so on and so forth. And then the sequel comes out and it's just terrible. So everyone kind of like forgot about it. I don't know how long it was between Exorcist 2 and this movie.
We should look that up because that's a good question. But I bet you it was a good long time.
I bet it was too. It's
because immediately after like The Exorcist 2, Linda Blair went into doing like women's prison exploitation films.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I'm not judging. Girls got to eat, but.
So The Exorcist, the original one, came out in 1973. The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, came out in 1977. And then this movie was released, The Exorcist 3, Legion, 13 years later in 1990. So yeah, pretty big gap there, and rightfully so.
Took a while for the public to wash the taste out of its mouth.
One could argue that this film introduces society to 90s horror.
You think?
1990. That'll work. But yeah, let's talk. My favorite part of this film, Exorcist 3, Legion, is the lead actor, George C. Scott.
Tremendous.
Fantastic. He plays a detective by the name of Kinderman, and I don't think we actually ever get like his first name. Everyone refers to him as Kinderman, and I mean his wife refers to him as honey or darling or whatever, but I don't recall ever hearing what his first name was. And then on IMDb, he's only credited as Kinderman.
Really, just Lieutenant Kinderman.
Yeah. And then
I should know because he was mentioned in the it's the same character that's in the original.
Yeah,
Kinderman. I mean, he's the guy.
Yeah,
he's the same character. Not the same actor, but the same character who's investigating it.
Mm-hmm.
And I even read the book after I saw the movie. The book is really good, too. I can't believe I don't remember his first name. I wonder if it ever was revealed.
I don't think it is in this film. An actor by the name of Ed Flanders plays Father Dyer. Powerful performance. That was being sarcastic. But powerful performer. The Gemini Killer is played by Brad Dourif, who most will recall as Wormtongue in The Two Towers and Return of the King and The Lord of the Rings. Trilogy by Peter Jackson.
And pretty much the whole of this movie, well, let's say 80% of this movie is in the interactions between George C. Scott's character, the detective, and Brad Dourif, who is a demon.
Yeah, a demon.
I mean, he's the plot twist, he happens to be inhabiting what was thought to be, the demon is now inhabiting the body of the detective's best friend, the hero priest from part one, who everyone assumed was dead, but has actually been sitting unidentified in this mental institution while the demon that he fought with in part one to save the girl from basically just rebuilds him from the inside out over years and years and years until it can then use him for its own obviously horrible purposes.
And then it becomes like this demon becomes a serial killer, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Known as the Gemini Killer, which is actually inspired by the real-life Zodiac Killer, or the name of him is.
He has a really interesting MO, though, since his body is, in fact, locked in a mental institution, mm-hmm. and he can't get out. Also in the mental institution are a lot of older people suffering from various forms of dementia or psychosis. And so the demon basically just sort of jumps onto them and can then sneak out of the hospital.
Yeah, he refers to it as child's play. And then the next like cut is of this redheaded kid that resembles Chucky. which is a nice little callback to horror nerds like us. And we always appreciate that. There's some, with those two actors, there's some killer monologues in this movie.
I think that's why I've seen it such an embarrassing number of times.
I mean,
just the monologues. At one point I had some of them memorized.
Yeah, they're fantastic. I mean, Brad Dourif goes off on like, I'm not like exaggerating, a 5-minute long monologue at one point to kind of explain like what his MO is and why he has taken over the priest's body from the first film. And it's really powerful. And then of course, George C. Scott is a thunderclap of an actor.
And one of the things that makes those interactions and the whole movie so successful is that in this movie, as in the original, the character that George C. Scott plays is an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a religious person. He knows that he doesn't understand how his friend, who he thought died, he knows he doesn't understand basically what happened in part one. But he's not at all a believer or a practicing Catholic, so he's having these conversations with the demon, and the demon is sort of teasing him and slowly revealing itself to be something other than just a man in a similar way that it did in part one with the priest.
Yeah, so, yeah, George C. Scott's character is, I mean, it's revealed pretty early. He's a non-believer. And the demon tries to, like, use that against him, you know, in certain ways. It's weird because in order to believe in demons and exorcism and the power of Christ compels you, you have to be a believer. And so this film asks, you know, a few interesting questions and bounces that like dynamic off of each other of a believer versus a non-believer. It's pretty neat.
Well, yeah, and it's also, I mean, I like the way it plays between those two things, but one of the things that's so interesting or upsetting about most supernatural horror movies, but possession movies in particular, and this movie in particular, mm-hmm. is that there's no shortage of supernatural evil.
No.
I mean, this was true in part one, too. There's no shortage of supernatural evil, but there's really no supernatural good. I mean, you can ask yourself, I suppose in this movie there's an argument at the very end, God intervenes and just the slightest way.
Yeah, and this is where it gets really interesting. So the film is written and directed by, say his name again.
William Peter Blatty,
who directed the first film.
No, he wrote the first
film. He wrote the first film, okay.
Yeah.
But he wrote the book for this film before he wrote the screenplay for this film, and it was called Legion. So the studio wanted a connector to the first one because the first one was such a blockbuster hit. They decided to call it Exorcist 3 Legion. So the screenplay gets done, blah, 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 and the studio goes, well, we have a problem. There is no exorcism in this film. So they had to reshoot the entire last third of the film to insert a character named Father Morning, who actually looks like a young Max von Sydow, the priest, one of the priests from the first and the second. He's actually in the second one, too. And to have this supernatural good character, and it cost them $4 million to do this exorcism.
It's a very visually effect heavy, dramatic.
Yeah,
you could argue a little silly at times. The climax that really doesn't fit the rest of the movie.
No, it doesn't. I almost forgot about it, that it was even in the film, because it's quick. It has nothing to do with the plot. They introduce this character in the last third of the film, and you're like, who is this guy? And then you think it'll be revealed eventually. It's not. Like, I thought, oh, okay, Father Morning must be a name I'm not remembering from the first film. And I went and looked it up. No. Like, they created this character just to create an exorcism scene that cost them $4 million just so they could call it The Exorcist 3 and have a good supernatural character, because there isn't one until him.
Well, there are no good ones anyway. There's plenty of supernatural evil.
Evil, you know, everywhere,
the,
yeah.
The demon gets to break the rules all the time.
Yeah.
But I do wonder what that says about... I mean, I'm not a religious person, and so I'm not approaching this as one, but in this sort of genre of movie where there is an abundance of supernatural evil, but almost no supernatural good, just the hint of it, like I said, at the very end... So what sort of a moral universe are we in here? And is it a reliably religious one? Is it a reliably or recognizably Catholic one?
Yeah, I think it's a Catholic one. You know, it's very Catholic. And the fact that Kinderman is a non-believer is almost like, it's almost like he has issues, you know, that battle with everyone else in the film, you know? I don't know, because if... You know, everyone he interacts with is, well, not everyone, I guess, because he does interact with police officers and nurses, but he interacts with a lot of priests, and they're all believers.
Well, yeah, his best friend is a priest.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I don't know. That's a good question. Because, well, he could, yeah. It's just, I think it's a Catholic universe they live in, or it's a bleak one. I mean, it's a bleak universe they live in, but
well, just like in the first movie, you know, the priest is only able to save the girl from a possession that's about to kill her, but the priest is only able to save her by basically taking the demon into himself, right? He takes one for the team. He can't force it out otherwise.
Yeah,
he's tried and he's failed. The other priest that was helping him has died. So that's his last move.
Yeah, he sacrifices.
He calls it into himself and then throws himself out a window.
Yeah. The ultimate good.
Sacrifice. Well, sure, although suicide is the original list of unforgivable sins.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, so there's that. So did he go to hell? Well, no, he didn't, because it's explained in this film what actually happened.
Because he didn't actually die. He was thought to be dead.
Yeah, yeah.
But and then in this movie, you know, spoiler alert, never listen to our shows about movies until you've
watch the film first, and then But or if you just have no interest, what else, and you know you're not going to watch it, listen, fine.
But in this movie, at the end, the detective is only able to save the priest from the demon by killing the priest, by shooting him again. There's this glimmer of supernatural good that gives them the tiniest bit of help right at the end, but still the only way to permanently save this priest who's been suffering since the first one and who's already sacrificed so much is to shoot him.
Yeah.
I mean, so again, what sort of moral universe is that?
Yeah, a bleak one. also, we forgot to mention, there is some supernatural good in this film, and it's besides the end, and it's manifested in Fabio's cameo.
Oh my God. Yeah,
the dream sequence.
The dream sequence in heaven where the angels are minor celebrities. And
Fabio's one of them.
There's a famous basketball player. And I'm such a nerd, I don't know sports.
Is it Patrick Ewing?
It might be.
I don't know. I can't remember if it was. I feel like it was, but I don't know. Too many people would have recognized that. But they do use, and we're going to call back to the first episode here, POV. And they only use it once. And it's when we don't. So Kinderman gets a phone call and then it cuts. And we have no idea what the phone call was. And it's POV of Kinderman coming into the hospital.
Oh,
to
yes.
Find when his friend, who's the priest.
When his friend who was in the hospital has been
dead.
Murdered.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
this is a separate priest than the one involved in the end. This was.
So on the anniversary of the events of The Atheist, these two best friends, one or of The Exorcist, not The Atheist.
That's a different movie.
Yeah, yeah. They get together, well, Kinderman being the atheist and Father Dyer, of course, being Catholic.
And they were both best friends with this priest who they presume has died after the events of the first film. And then so on the anniversary of his death, they get together and they go have themselves a little mandate.
Which is talk
theology.
Yeah, and go see It's a Wonderful Life in theaters.
It's a Wonderful.
And after they see It's a Wonderful Life, we get this wonderful monologue. And this has nothing to like really do. I don't understand, but it's great. This wonderful monologue by George C. Scott about wanting to kill a live carp that's in his bathtub.
It's one of those completely tangential little asides that if you took it out, I'm not sure I could love the movie.
It shouldn't work, though. But because it's George C. Scott, it's potent. And like you're like, okay, this has something to do with this character. The fact that carp is a delicious fish, but there are toxins in it. So you have to buy it live.
You
got to
watch the scene, but the crux of it is that his wife is keeping a live carp in the bathtub until she's ready to cook it. And George C. Scott is confessing to his priest friend that every time he goes into the bathroom and sees that carp,
he wants to murder
swimming,
it. Yeah.
Moving its gills.
He wants to murder it.
It's so good.
These murders are brutal. Like, he has, the Gemini killer has calling cards and so on and so forth. But when we get the POV of Kinderman, we find out that, yes, his priest friend has been killed. And then all of his blood has been extracted from him without spilling a drop into little jars. And then up above him in his in his blood, it says, "It's a Wonderful Life," which is so like that's just so twisted and dark. And somebody knows these two guys are, you know, getting some form of love, compassion, sympathy from "It's a Wonderful Life," and then he mocks that, you know. And so it's an interesting take on a demon being a serial killer, you know?
Is that
just dark?
Is that scene before or after the little clip of the elderly patient in the mental asylum crawling on the ceiling like a spider?
It's before.
Okay.
Because that's at the towards the end of the film when we find the demented old lady that was in the room, that was apparently in the room when Father Dyer got all of his blood extracted from him.
And of course, they can't figure out, what she was doing in the room. And it never occurs to them that, you know, she was draining all the blood from her body because she was sort of temporarily possessed
by
a demon.
The
and I think
killer,
that's
yeah.
just sloppy police work.
Yeah, it's terrible police work. I mean, bring down the police state. creepy. But
well, it really avoids going over the top for the longest time. You know, we're talking about how that ending scene doesn't really seem like it fits because it is just so it is so over the top, and it is so effects heavy, and out of character with the rest of the movie, because the rest of the movie, even though, like you said, there's gore in it, and you know, they're tracking a serial killer, so there are killings in it, but it's not explicit, really. It's so good at, you know, not showing you everything, and which is a mistake that a lot of more contemporary horror
movies like make. A lot of, you don't get to see what Father Dyer looked like after he was killed.
No, like, you're not present.
They tell you, oh, he was decapitated, and a statue of Jesus's head was put where his head should be. And, you know,
that's like, a bad Monday.
Oh, man. But what's brutal about this is they don't ever show it, is the murder weapon, which is, I've never seen anything like it. It's like garden shears for the Terminator, and it looks like it's for quick amputations, you know?
And we get a brief explanation from a very creepy, socially awkward morgue attendant. Although, really, how could you not be socially awkward if you're...
And creepy.
Yeah.
It's kind of
Who just, you know, explains that it's a piece of medical equipment. But it really does just look like garden shears for cutting people's heads off. You can't imagine what else you would use.
It looks like a giant crab claw made out of chrome and just smooth as, you know, like a 67 Mustang.
The Terminator as designed by Lovecraft.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the crab claw. Yeah, the murders are brutal. The decapitation replaced with Jesus's head. That's pretty intense. And then they don't ever show it. They show Kinderman looking under the sheet.
Yeah,
that's and then a great his shot. Face of disgust and pain and terror, which of course George C. Scott just can nail.
Yeah,
and that's it. That's all you get. So. They have that, there's that little bit of class to this film, I think, which it's more like a murder mystery than an exorcism film. And there's some people who like, I know there's some reviews that this one's better than the original because it's a completely different film.
Yeah, you know, I said that at the beginning, and I'm not sure I believe it. I think you have to give the first one precedence just because it's, or preference simply because it was the first one and it broke so many, it did things that films hadn't done before, and it had such a huge effect both on, like, you know, future films and then the culture at large.
Yeah.
But this is a sequel of a rare quality. Let's say that even with the slightly over the top ending, maybe not so slightly. Even with that ending, this is a rare sequel, and so much of it is carried by George C. Scott. And one of my favorite things about him in this movie is just how weary he is. It's just like he's how sort of low grade, disappointed, you know, like the lone guy trying to keep the world from falling to hell in every way possible.
And he's got that tired voice.
And you get to watch him constantly abuse his subordinates in the police department verbally.
Dude.
I mean,
oh, man.
Usually with like. Excerpts from Shakespeare.
He's so
That's fun.
Good at that in films he does. Like in the 1982, the bleakest Christmas Carol that was ever made, the 1982 A Christmas Carol with George C. freaking Scott as Scrooge. You believe he hates people. And you do in this film too. Like,
he gives off a vibe in this film of, I know I shouldn't hate people. But I do. But I'm going to do my best to be a good person anyway.
Mm-hmm. Which you know, I just love that when you find out that the atheist is better than the Catholic, you know, or vice versa.
Well, yeah, I mean, in some of the cases.
Yeah. But he I know, like, he didn't want to do the reshoots. They had to do the reshoots on that last third of the film. So I'm sure he might have part of that disgust and like tiredness we see in him might be from the fact that he was tired of making this movie, you know. But I'm sure he got paid well.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Because I mean, despite the fact that he might not have wanted to be there in that the final third, he delivered one of the best, most memorable monologues about evil or the nature of evil.
Yep.
In any movie.
But, and then, of course, and this is the, well, this is the ultimate irony in all supernatural horror movies, and certainly in all possession movies, and it's the revelation of evil that mm-hmm. finally convinces the detective and the presence, however, you know, quasi-useless of yeah. supernatural good.
Yeah, exactly. Because he believes in all this evil. I guess he's saying, what I took from it was that, yes, I believe in all this ugly, nasty crap because I can see it, taste it, feel it. But he doesn't necessarily believe in God. That's not what I don't think that's what he's saying there, you know. I think he's still sticking to his atheist guns.
But no, you know? I think at that point it's both. Yeah. I think he's saying that, you know, that he believes in evil, and now having seen it, like the real thing,
yeah.
You know, the bona fide supernatural evil.
Terrible.
So, you know, he by yeah. default believes in God, but it's not at all a happy revelation.
No, yeah. And I mean, he's in a lot of pain when it's happening, and that's why he's so like angry and distraught when he says the monologue. It's really good stuff. I do want to mention an iconic scene in this film. I've read that it might be the most famous jump scare of all time in horror cinema.
I already know what you're talking about. You're talking about guys. The hallway scene
guys.
In the mental institution.
Guys.
At night.
Gals. Ladies, gentlemen.
Which,
wow.
I mean, you never see coming. Well, let's start with that. It's so well done. You never see it coming.
I don't want to spoil it because I want everybody to know how terrifying it is. But even knowing it's coming, it's still freaking terrifying and awesome.
Oh, yeah, it's going to get you.
So it's a stagnant scene of a hall, and you know something's about to happen. But here's the trick.
Wide shot.
It takes forever. And there's even a false jump. Where she finds the cop in the room.
A little bit of a red herring
yeah.
in there.
And then you're throw like, you off. Yeah, yeah. And you're like, oh, okay, that was it, you know. But then it goes back to that same stagnant white hallway shot. And throughout the movie, they do these quick zooms. And there's this sound, almost like metal turning or something that they use for the creepy sound, you know. It's in like the first scene of the film too, when the doors blow
yeah, the sound
open,
design is really well
Jesus
done.
And Jesus' eyes open on the statue. Yeah, it's really well done.
So, this kind of primordial mm-hmm. howling.
Yeah, it's really, it's chilling.
And imagine a baby demon who just wants some milk.
I mean, not to go back to the baby demon, the children that want to eat your face, but yeah, yeah.
So, I might just be reflecting on my kid's bedtime last night. Or projecting.
There's this nurse that's checking out. She's at her desk, but she's also like checking rooms. You can tell something's around. She's hearing things. There's the red herring in one of the rooms, and everybody jumps, and it's scary, and then it goes back, and your brain plays a trick on you, where it's like, I know something's coming, but it's taking so long, it's kind of like going to sleep. Like, they did this intentionally.
It's a long shot. You're watching her just, you know, take care of very mundane
monotonous
tasks at night in yeah. a hospital. And
the
again,
cops come in and get coffee.
And you're right. It's the length of it. Because yeah. Even though you know something has to happen, mm-hmm. or, you know, you wouldn't be sitting here watching it.
Yeah.
It goes on for so long, you relax a little bit.
Yeah. And then all of a freaking sudden, the quick zoom with the metal turning, baby crying sound. And it's this white nun. And you don't see the face of the nun because it's from the side because she's crossing the hallway from one door to the nurse's head, and she has her elbows up with the amputating Terminator
shears. The Lovecraft crab claws.
Yeah,
that's hard to say. Lovecraft
crab claws.
Lovecraft
yeah.
crab claws.
Yeah, that's a tongue twister. And just going after the nurse's head, quick, fast. It's so scary. It's so creepy. It's one of the most well-done, classy jump scares. Like, normally, I don't like jump scares in horror films. I think they're cheap. I really do. I'm like, if this is all you're going to give me, like I rewatched Scream the other night. Love the film. I really do. there's so many like jump scares that miss because they tried to throw so many in there. Like, it probably would have worked in theaters, but it doesn't work when you watch it at home or on your computer. You know, like I watched it. Well, I watched this film on my computer the other night, and it scared the crap out of me, the jump scare, because it's more of like a visual thing too than we're just going to use ring to scare you, you know, which is Scream, you know. But it's really well done. If you do want to see it, it is on YouTube, and it you'll pee your pants.
Let me ask you this question: in the your personal pantheon of let's say just possession movies, where does this one rank?
It's number two.
Number two.
Exorcist is number one.
Sure.
I've seen some bad ones.
There was a while where they were cranking them out.
Just bad ones. Exorcist, the beginning is not bad with the Skarsgård actor and they're in the Middle East.
Yeah, no, that's not horrible. It's worth watching.
Yeah.
Again, I think they went back and redid the ending of that one too.
They did, yeah. And there's two endings to that
film. Yeah, it made it way worse.
Yeah. And then there's The Exorcism of Emily Rose, which is actually just a courtroom drama. And so I don't know.
Did you see The Right with Anthony Hopkins?
Yes.
That I thought was surprisingly well done.
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, well, it's Anthony Hopkins. Yeah. But I mean, he's not in it a whole lot, really.
No, he's not. And that, because he's on the poster, and that's what drew me to that film. I was kind of disappointed with that one because I wanted more Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Well, sure, but even in Silence of the Lambs, he's on screen for
11 minutes. 11
minutes.
And
crazy.
Won a fucking Oscar. So, sorry for the explicitness.
But no, The Right. Look that. I don't know which service it's streaming on right now, but if you're in possession movies, that also is another good one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's so many. They do all the tropes, you know, crawling on the walls, the crab crawl, the throw up. That all started with this trilogy. The Exorcist.
What gets me is when the demon knows things that it can't know. That's when that gives me the shivers.
Oh, yeah, me too. It's like, how do you know that?
All right, speaking of knowing things that you shouldn't know, you can find our podcast if you're not already subscribed to it. This is the second episode, so we're now listed on Spotify, in the Apple directory. We should be available on whatever your preferred distribution channel and or podcast player is. If you haven't already, please do take a second and go to the Apple Podcast directory or your preferred directory and leave us a review. It helps so much.
Please. Thank you.
So we've heard algorithmically to get the show out there. And obviously, if anyone needs to have their message out there, it's us, right?
It's us, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
What else is in the
world? I mean, yeah. Nothing but horror and terror.
And carp. It's a tasty fish.
Yeah. Like, share, subscribe, rate, review, critique us, you know. Let us know if there's any topic you would like for us to discuss or film. Because we're not just going to do films. We started with two great ones.
Oh, God, you're going to make me read a book,
cult ones. I'm not, Jonathan. There's Audible.